This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. $29.62. I will explain. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, today, the 10th of January. I do believe, good as always, to have you along, everybody. $29.62 is the difference today between the price of a barrel of Brent North Sea crude oil, the international benchmark, and the price of a barrel of Russian crude, known commonly as Urals, as in the mountains, Urals. Which is to say that while, yes, Russian oil can now be had on the relative cheap if international sanctions don't bother you, it's also a sign that those sanctions, including a price cap on Urals, seems to be working. Mostly, but we'll get to that. There had been some skepticism about whether Europe and Australia and the G7 could pull that price cap off. But the bottom line is that the sanctions and the price difference should mean less revenue for Russia to finance its war on Ukraine. But as Marketplace's Sabri Benishaw reports to get us going, there is plenty more of this story left to play out.
The U.S., Europe, Japan, Australia, Canada, and the U.K. appear to have bent global oil markets to their will. Ben Cahill is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He says this is how they did it.
These countries barred all of the support services that are used for seaborne exports for any transaction above $60 a barrel.
You're buying oil and want boat insurance?
$60 per barrel.
You want financing for that oil?
$60 a barrel.
Commodity brokering services for that oil?
$60 per barrel.
G7 countries were able to force this because they provide 90% of these maritime services, says Cahill. But at least as important as the price cap has been the fact that most of Europe is embargoing Russian oil. Ewan Craik is president of Petroleum at Argus Media.
Russian oil exports have already fallen somewhat. So in December, they're about just under 20% lower than they were the previous month.
One type of Russian oil called Urals is half the price of the European benchmark. Russia is diverting some of that oil to India, Turkey, and China. India has gone from importing zero Russian oil to 1.2 million barrels a day, Craig says. But
when you have to ship your crude to markets like China, in India, you have to pay money to ship it there, and for it to be competitive, the price has to be lower.
But if the goal of these sanctions is to deal a gut punch to Russia's oil revenue, that's not quite happening, says Ken Egan, European sovereign analyst for KBRA.
Russian revenues have somewhat dwindled in 2022. However, relative to other recent years, revenues are still substantially high.
And some reasons for the sanctions appearing to work have nothing to do with the sanctions. Oil demand has been depressed by a mild winter in Europe, and China's oil-hungry economy hasn't yet fully woken up from zero COVID, says Joan Feldbaum-Vidra, senior managing director at KBRA.
So a lot depends on just the global macro situation as well in terms of demand.
She says the longer the price controls and embargo persist, the more opportunities to cheat those sanctions and the greater the risk to their effectiveness. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishaw for Marketplace.
You know, it occurs to me listening to Sabri's story and thinking about how I set it up that we never did say how much crude is going for, did we? Brent North Sea, $79.75 a barrel at the close today in New York. Equities, also in New York, mostly up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Burbank, California is where we go now, the corporate headquarters of the Walt Disney Company, where starting 1 March, the once and present CEO Bob Iger wants workers to be 4 days a week. No, not actually at headquarters, but in the office, wherever that office might be. We mentioned this yesterday, Iger's email to Disney's 200,000-some-odd employees in which he said, in a creative business like ours, nothing can replace the ability to connect, observe, and create with peers that comes from being physically together. 2 questions come to mind. How are 200,000 people going to take that new mandate, number one? And maybe more importantly, how are Disney's competitors going to take it? Marketplace's Matt Levin is on that one.
Iger unretired late last year to restore Disney's creative mojo. The company's stock fell 44% in 2022, its worst year since Herbie Rides Again was in theaters, the 1974 version, not the Lindsay Lohan one. Anyway, Iger's argument that Zoom is a mojo killer and real rooms are just better, that has some research behind it, says Melanie Brooks at Columbia Business School.
There's a more spontaneity of having these interactions and having people talk who maybe otherwise wouldn't be talking, which is super valuable for creativity.
Maybe if the people who made the Disney Plus show Obi-Wan shared a cafeteria lunch with the people who made Andor, Obi-Wan would have been a lot better. But Iger is taking an obvious gamble with increasing the Disney weekly attendance quota from 3 days to 4.
There's competition out there, and employees prefer flexibility. And so it's possible that you're going to lose out on talent.
Disney's rivals now have a choice. They can say, hey, Disney is doing 4 days a week in the office, so we're going to do that too. Or they can say, hey, talented Disney employee, come work for us and you can work anywhere. Sadal Neely at Harvard Business School says that choice depends a lot on who is CEO.
I think age and gender, those backgrounds do make a difference.
Older and male CEOs often underestimate how remote work can translate to a much more diverse talent pool.
Women and people of color disproportionately prefer more remote, not less.
Disney may also have trouble keeping talent just because of where many of its offices are located, traffic-heavy Southern California. Caroline Walsh is with the consulting firm Gartner.
When we interviewed workers, commute time is the number one barrier to using the office.
And while Disneyland may be the happiest place on Earth, the unhappiest place may be a Los Angeles freeway during rush hour. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
There is news of student loans today, specifically how those loans get repaid. What are known as income-driven repayment plans have been around for decades, letting people who make less money pay less money on their student debt. The process, though, has been charitably cumbersome. Today, the Biden administration proposed new regulations to make it easier for eligible borrowers to pay less on a regular basis, yes, but also to give those who take on relatively small amounts of student debt to begin with the ability to get rid of it sooner. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more on that.
Melissa Hefner paid for most of her undergraduate degree in anthropology herself, but she did have to take out a $6,000 loan. Since graduating in 2012, she's paid $85 a month toward the debt and estimates she'll be done in another 10 years.
It's kind of like if I took out a loan for a car for $6,000 and I'm still paying on it 20 years later when I don't even maybe own the car anymore.
Under the proposed regulations, people like Hefner, who borrowed less than $12,000 for their undergraduate education, could qualify to have their debt forgiven after making regular payments for a decade. In the current income-driven repayment plan, forgiveness takes 20 years. James Quall is Undersecretary for the Department of Education.
So what our proposal would do is have a shorter period of repayment for smaller loans so that you wouldn't have to stay in debt for 20 years if you only borrowed a few thousand dollars.
Undersecretary Quall points out many people who borrow small amounts for college don't finish their degrees, which means they may struggle to pay their debts back.
That leaves students in the worst of both worlds. They have debt, but they didn't earn that degree that will qualify them for additional jobs.
It makes sense to align the amount borrowed with the time it takes to be forgiven, says Sandy Baum, a higher education economist at the Urban Institute.
If you're starting college, certainly should be a question that if you borrow $50,000, you're going to have more of a repayment burden than if you borrow $20,000.
For example, people who attend community college tend to borrow less. And the Department of Education estimates that 85% of all community college borrowers would have their debts wiped out under this new plan. This can also remove psychological barriers to attending college, says Mark Huelsman with the Hope Center for College, Community, and Justice at Temple.
There are some students who don't begin college at all or drop out because of the very rational fear of needing to pay off their student loans or being stuck in debt for life.
People with higher incomes could also qualify for the shorter repayment period, but they'll have to pay more each month than people who earn less. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
The National Federation of Independent Businesses releases a survey every month. It's called the Small Business Optimism Index, and it looks at how the owners of those small businesses are feeling about the economy. According to the latest survey, which is December, the answer is they're not feeling especially great, those small business owners, a third of them saying inflation is their main issue. No surprise, right? But as with a lot of the macro ways to look at this economy, there's a micro, too. We like to do those. So we got one of our retail regulars on the phone the other day. Philip Rollins owns the record comic and toy store Offbeat in downtown Jackson, Mississippi.
Over the holiday period, it went pretty well. Actually, surprisingly well. It was some stuff that I had in here that I thought I would never move. I had like a lot of high dollar items. Like recently, I bought a collection and in it had two rare copies of a Taylor Swift 45. They can go online for like upwards to like $200 and more. And I actually sold one of them, which I thought I never would personally. I thought I had to take it online. But I underestimate the power and monetary value of Swifties, apparently. After the holidays, January just hits a, as for most retail places, it's either you're getting returns or it's like a dead zone. So January and the summer tend to be like my most hated months for me personally, because it's just so slow. But otherwise, I mean, I'm still getting like a little bit more traffic. People are still discovering the shop. The college students haven't really gotten fully back in yet. I think they come back this week. So I know some kids will start, you know, probably start coming to the shop. But otherwise, business isn't super terrible. So far, I mean, 2023 seems to be going okay for the first week. As a business owner, I'm kind of jaded because just the way inflation is going. I was talking to one of my old street team members. He was just hanging out here at the shop. And I was just like, I have to go back and look at every single one of the records I get in now and check the suggested retail price on it. And stuff has jumped up. Easily up to $5. For example, a Lauryn Hill record that was $25 last year is now $30, maybe $35. That extra $5 does make a difference for people to be like, I'm gonna get one or I'm gonna get two records. I try to keep in mind of that this may not last forever. And giving that knowledge and whatnot, I'm like, okay, is there a way for this shop to pivot or adapt any more than it already has? When I opened up this shop, I opened up with the mindset of that I knew that having just a comic book shop or just a record store wouldn't work by itself. So these things have to kind of play off each other. Yeah, it's worrying, but it's like, it's nothing I can do about it. It's like, okay, I just need to really buckle down and figure out how to adapt to everything.
Philip Rollins buckling down and running Offbeat in Jackson, Mississippi. Coming up.
And that's because being sick is expensive.
Yeah, sure is. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 186 today, about a half percent, 33,704 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ rose 106 points, about 1%, 10,742. The S&P 500, 27 points to the good, 0.7%, 39.19. We heard from Matt Levin that Disney wants its people back in the office in person. Will that tempt employees to look at more hybrid-friendly competitors, Matt asked? Don't know. Walt Disney sprang up 0.8% today. Comcast grew almost 0.9%. Warner Brothers Discovery, which Goldman Sachs today called its favorite media stock, jumped almost 0.8%. Sabri was talking about the oil cap on Russian oil prices, the price cap, rather. Looking at domestic oil stocks then. How about that? ExxonMobil rose 1.5%. Chevron up 0.5%. Diamondback Energy jumped 0.3%. Diamondback's ticker symbol. Anybody going to get this? I'll give you like 2 seconds. I got to go. Fang, Diamondback, Rattlesnake, get it? You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Behind every successful business is a story. And some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Republicans in the House of Representatives have passed the first piece of legislation of their new majority to cut about $80 billion over 10 years of new funding that the Internal Revenue Service got in the Inflation Reduction Act a number of months ago. As it happens, Catherine Rampell of The Washington Post, whom you might also know from occasional Fridays on this program, got a rare peek inside the IRS a little bit ago. So we have gotten her on the phone to talk about that and other things economic having to do with the 118th Congress. Hey, Catherine.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so this was a great piece. I remember reading it. Do me a favor, though, and remind me where you were when you got this little trip inside the IRS.
I went to an IRS service center in Austin, Texas, which is basically where the magic happens, where your tax returns get processed, particularly if they are paper returns. And it was wild. It was like going on the weirdest Willy Wonka tour you can possibly imagine, because this is a place that is usually, you know, locked down to anybody right. from the outside, right. understandably, lots of privacy concerns. But they let me go through on a very heavily chaperoned tour where I got to see, you know, this incredibly archaic technology that's used to process your tax returns, including software from the 1970s, very heavily paper-based, physical manual stamping of things, somebody going through tax returns with a red pen and circling things. Wow. It was wild and sort of depressing.
No, I'm sure it was. Were there just tax returns piled everywhere? That's what I imagine, right? Some huge room
yes.
with tax returns piled
yes.
everywhere.
If you for those listening, if you are interested, you can go back and look up the story that I wrote. The cafeteria in this facility was stacked wall to wall and about shoulder high with paper tax returns that were just awaiting processing. It looked like a corn maze almost, of just these tax returns everywhere. And this is the cafeteria. It's because they had run out of storage space to cram all of these paper returns that were going through the process. And I should point out, most people do file electronically, but even if you file electronically, you can still get stuck in paper purgatory because the technology, their IT is so outdated that if, there's any sort of issue with your return, you forgot to sign a page on it. They have some discrepancy in the numbers that you put in there, that you can't fit enough dependents, on the form, for example, whatever it is. They will reach out to you. The IRS will reach out to you by snail mail.
Yeah.
And then you have to respond to them by snail mail or fax.
Fax machines. Goodness.
The whole process is very painful, very paper-based.
I love the gentle implication of the IRS will reach out to you. Anyway, yes. but let me ask you this. So the IRS got all this new money in the Inflation Reduction Act to take care of this problem, right?
Well, some of the money is to be used for enforcement. A little over half of it is for enforcement. So that means, ramping up auditing, particularly concentrated in auditing of more complex tax returns, higher income taxpayers, corporations. And then the other half of it is for things like upgrading IT, improving customer service. If you've ever tried to call the IRS, it is a nightmare and you can wait on the phone for a very, very long time and never reach anyone, which, of course, is frustrating. It's annoying for taxpayers. It's also not good for voluntary compliance. So there's, the enforcement piece of it, which is about involuntary compliance.
Yeah.
And then how do you make sure that people who want to obey the law actually can obey the law? And given our complicated tax code, it's often quite challenging. So that money would be invested in ideally making it a better experience for taxpayers, as good as it can be when you're filing taxes.
We should say here that this bill has something approaching zero chance of becoming law, and that it will probably not get a hearing in the Senate of the United States. I do wonder, though, given what the Republicans in the House seem to be after with this bill and some of the other things that were in the rules package, what is your level of concern about this economy in the new Congress?
I have concern on a couple of different levels. One is that if we have the misfortune of having a recession, I think it will be very challenging to imagine a scenario in which Congress is able to respond promptly or at all in the way that normally Congress would respond with some form of fiscal stimulus, more generous unemployment insurance, et cetera. Given that we have divided government, given that there are still a lot of complaints with the last previous rounds of stimulus relating to the pandemic recession, et cetera. My bigger concern, however, would be more of a self-inflicted recession that might come from a crisis over the debt ceiling.
Yep.
Which I know you have covered many times before, but basically the idea is that Congress has to authorize an increase to our borrowing limit that doesn't actually have anything to do with new spending. It just means paying off existing bills that Congress has passed, have already incurred through their past spending and tax decisions. But the debt ceiling needs to be raised. It's sort of this like archaic thing that's still around. If it is not raised, and we default on our debt,
Very bad things happen,
difficult to pay military salaries, social security checks, et cetera. And you can have panic throughout global financial markets, which is again, why I get back to, there could be a self-inflicted wound here of a recession that I'm very worried about.
Catherine Rampell, The Washington Post, this show on Fridays. Also, the author of a really interesting article on the Internal Revenue Service, kind of depressing. Catherine, thanks a bunch. I appreciate you taking time midweek.
Thanks, Kai.
See ya. It's expensive in this economy to be poor. Life, all of life, just costs you more if you're without sufficient means. And that goes for food, too. And the costs are more than just monetary. People who struggle to afford food or to get enough to eat often have more health problems. And as if to prove the premise with which this introduction started, a study just published in the journal Health Affairs found families that are food insecure also spend about 20% more on health care than families that aren't. Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
There are a lot of reasons that being food insecure can have a negative impact on your health.
If you're worried about having enough food, if you have sort of a limited food budget, you often have to rely on sort of low-cost, cheaper, less healthy food options.
Dr. Deepak Palakshappa is a professor at Wake Forest University and one of the study authors. He says eating less healthy food can lead to all sorts of health issues, like weight gain, diabetes, or high blood pressure. Then there's also the stress of constantly worrying about food.
And this is particularly the case for parents when they're constantly worried about how do I feed my child? And just the stress of worrying about that leads to worse mental health, leads to worse physical health.
And that, he says, can lead to more trips to the doctor, more prescriptions, and higher healthcare costs. Dr. Seth A. Berkowitz at the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill, another study author, says that's exactly what's happening for families that are food insecure.
We see more inpatient hospitalizations, more emergency department visits, more spending on medications and those kind of things.
That's true, he says, regardless of whether a family is insured or uninsured or has different kinds of insurance.
Food insecurity does predispose adults and kids to poor health, but we also have to realize that poor health predisposes people in the U.S. to food insecurity, and that's because being sick is expensive.
Dr. Hillary Seligman is a professor at the University of California, San Francisco. She says there are programs around the country at various hospitals and through some insurance companies that let doctors basically prescribe fruits and vegetables.
We know that these programs can help people to be more food secure. We know that they support healthier dietary intake. But the programs tend to be small, they tend to be short duration, and they tend to not give a sufficient amount of food to have a real impact.
To have a real impact, both on people's health and on healthcare costs, she says these kinds of programs would need to be scaled way up and last a lot longer. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, I'm sure you've heard in hourly newscasts or perhaps seen on the social media feed of your choice that Fed Chair Jay Powell was talking about climate change today.
We are not, and we will not be, a climate policymaker.
Now, to be clear and to be fair, that was 4 seconds of a 4-minute and 58-second opening statement at a Bank of Sweden panel on central bank independence. Now, why, you might ask, would Powell bring up climate change as a thing the Fed is not gonna do? Here's why.
For us, central bank independence is a matter of statute. It's not in our constitution. It's just an institutional arrangement that has served the public well. Nothing more, nothing less.
And the fact is that Jay Powell keeps up on the news just like the rest of us. And he knows there are members of the new majority in Congress and members of the old majority, too, it has to be said, who don't much like some of the things the Fed does. And what Powell wants more than almost anything, except probably inflation getting back to 2%, is to not give Congress a reason to start making noise about Fed independence.
To keep it, we need to deserve it. And that means stick to that work and don't look for broader things.
And that is why Jay Powell was talking about climate change today. All right, we got to go. No real time for a moment of economic context today, but I'll tell you what, better an extra minute and a half of Catherine Rampell than 30 seconds of me. I promise you, it's a better deal. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Mieten and Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the executive director of digital and on-demand around here. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.